So today we have David Atkinson presenting today. And so David, are you going to talk about two things or one thing?
Two things.
Oh, okay, great. So I'll let you introduce your own topic. But I think that David did a bunch of interesting work at Epic, is that right? Before he started as a PhD student that I've always been interested in learning more about. And so he's offered to talk a little bit about that.
People.
In addition to his current research.
So most of this is going to be that eBosch presentation, which I'll get to in a bit. But I guess I wanted to take advantage of all of the patching experts here to just present kind of a very quick setup and sort of puzzling set of results that I'm getting, and maybe get some ideas for what I should do next. So here, what I'm interested in is the question of if you have a reasoning model, one sort of model of what it's doing is it's generating a bunch of answers. It then somehow chooses between these answers if it conflicts, and you can get into like when does it choose to generate more answers, when does it choose to terminate. But ultimately, it has this choice at the end where it wants to identify the good answer and distinguish that from all the bad answers. And so here's just a straightforward example of the setting that I'm working with. So this is GSM 8K. Is that not? Is it not advancing?
Oh, wait.
Oh, maybe it's just slow. And so, yeah, so we have this problem. It's kind of like, maybe an arc problem. And the good answer just solves it perfectly. The bad answer, this is an organic rollout
model.
This is on 1.5B, so the R1 when 1.5B distill. And I just need to click through everything. Okay, so and I've highlighted these in red. Generally, the errors tend to be either arithmetic errors, although that's less common. More common is it just does the wrong operation. And then we have this like even worse answer, which is just egregious. And so we have this setup where it hallucinates 900 red squares as a result of multiplying by 4 by 15. And so then we have this question of like how does it choose between them? And
Oh, yes. Just slow down a little bit. Yeah, go back to the previous slide.
What's the difference between a bad and a worse answer?
That's a great question. I will get to that in a second.
Okay.
So I guess the first thing that I wanted to do is
No, David, I have some questions.
yeah.
So there are like three types of answers for the same question you got. Is it through sampling or how did you?
Yes, it's through sampling.
I see. And what do you mean by choose between these answers?
Yeah, so if you look at that setup right there, sorry. So what we have is I've taken the blue are two different organic rollouts, and I then concatenated them together. So like I've added the black text and then sort of added this prompt to choose between them, and then importantly here I've forced it to choose an answer. So
Right.
normally it would roll out and give the full answer. Here I've said stop thinking and then immediately give me the first token of the answer.
I see. So you like force the think tokens with these two answers and somehow force it to like decide between these answers.
And the black text that you put in, is that like typical of text that it might have generated on its own?
So I played a little fast and loose with this. I found like two examples of and then I inserted it.
I see.
So it does exist in the wild. I'm not sure how common it is.
I see. That's great.
So I guess here the first thing I wanted to check is whether sort of, what happens when you do this? So do we actually have this ordering? And basically what you can see is like, so when you run this model, when you just give it the good answer, give it a normal end of think token, and then let it run normally, It almost always chooses the right answer, which is 66. When you give it the bad answer, or the bad rollout, the bad rollout has an associated answer of 70 or an implied answer of 70. It usually does not choose that answer. So it usually kind of like knows that something is wrong, self-corrects, but like doesn't fully self-correct and ends up somewhere where it shouldn't. Sometimes it does fully self-correct, you can see here. And then the worst answer is mostly does the same thing. Sometimes a little bit more likely it fully self-corrects.
When you say self-corrects, it completely disregards what it has generated in the thinking process and goes back to the right answer.
Yeah. So in the like non-thinking process, it will say, you know, here's the answer, and then go through the steps.
Oh, so it'll generate a chain of thought outside the thought token.
Yeah, yeah. So it will present that as kind of like explaining the answer. But
okay. And when you say good, bad, and worse, in the last slide you saw two explanations. But when you say good, bad, what does that mean?
Yeah. So here, what I have is just this is the good explanation. This is the correct one.
Uh-huh.
And then this is the bad. This is the bad trace.
Okay.
I've elided the worse trace. So in theory, there's like an even more egregious set of blue text that you could put in there, and you get different results. So here I'm just trying to explain like what happens when you combine these two.
Okay. So in the table, when you say good, both of these are good.
So in the table in this row,
uh-huh.
I'm not doing this. So I'm not combining.
This is only one.
Thing, and then you end the thing. Okay.
Do you suffer the good and bad?
Yes. So you'll see here, the next row is,
oh, okay,
I concatenate the good with the bad. And then the row after that, I concatenate the bad with the good.
Mm.
And I can't tell. So either here or the next slide, there's this preference for the second rollout. But that might only happen when you force it to answer.
Also, I think I might have missed something, but what are these multiple values for round results, like multiple tuples?
Yeah, so these are, this is the answer, and then this is the count of the times that you see. So I rolled out, you know,
okay,
30 times or whatever.
Okay. And 30 is the answer, and this is the number of rollouts, 6. Okay.
Exactly. Yeah, so 30 is the answer, and then we saw that 28 times, and then 66, we saw that 3 times.
Okay. What's the baseline?
What do you mean the baseline?
So these are your think force, right? Like, what do you consider the baseline for this is?
I'm not sure I follow.
Baseline or if you just let it generate its own thoughts freely,
yeah.
Then how often does it get this one right?
Oh, I see. Yeah. So. About 80% of the time.
Or the other question is, do you think letting it run the thought is your baseline, or just forcing it not to think at all is the baseline?
I think letting it run normally should be the baseline, but it depends what you're trying to do.
Okay.
And so, yeah, I guess here what I take from this ordering is we don't quite have a full kind of like total ordering, but I wanted to get a total ordering. So what I did is
step through why it's not a total ordering first.
So it might be a total. Let me double check. So here, if we have good and bad, we have 66 first. We have bad and good. I see. So here, it does not choose 66, which is the right answer, despite the fact that 66 is in the chain of thought. So, you know, possibly it's being confused by the bad, possibly it's self-correcting. But if you have the setup where you force it to answer, then you do have this kind of total ordering that you would like. So
force it to answer without further explanation.
Yes. So sorry.
It includes the boxed, right?
Yeah. So here, if you just do the box, it does not have that. So here you have this problem of like it still chooses bad, But if you prompt in self-reflection, you do get this this total order. So yeah, this is just for this particular example. So I'm not sure it's like super crucial to understand the specific results, but this is just kind of how I got to this prompt setup where, you know, here, if you have good and bad, it'll choose good. If you choose bad and good, it'll choose good. If you have bad and good and worse, it'll choose good. And then bad and worse, it'll always choose bad. And for all of these, for all the examples that I'll show you, I kind of like verify that for.
So before this, what were you doing? There's no, I need to select the right answer.
So here I have, you know, this like, let me check, and then I force the answer. Here I have stop thinking and then force the answer. Previously, I just had stop thinking and then did no forcing of the answer.
So you just press in three examples and then you don't say anything after the last one.
So I present two concatenated examples and then, yeah. Right. Yeah, I mean, I think the thing to take away from here is, you know, in this setup that we have, which is we have a good rollout, we have a let me double check, we have a bad rollout, and then we have this like reflection prompt. It will always choose the good rollout, or it will empirically 90% of the time choose the good rollout. And then if you concatenate the worst rollout with the bad rollout, for example, it will almost always choose the bad answer. So I have this patching setup where what I would like to do is by patching from this concatenated good rollout, let me double check bad rollout, think to the bottom row of the worst plus the bad. I want it to change the answer from the bad to the worst answer, to the associated worst answer. And the logic here is that, you know, here these are token aligned. The good rollout and the worst rollout have been chosen to have the same number of tokens. And so I'm just patching from the exact same bad token to the bad token. And the theory is that if you do that and you get worse answer, what you've patched in is the sense of the rollout that I'm in right now is not the good one. It's kind of like worse than the previous one. And so I'm not patching in anything about the content. I'm just patching in like some sense of relative validity. Does that make sense? Do people have questions about the patching setup?
I'm not 100% clear. Okay. So both of these things, they are exactly the same. They only differ between the good rollout and the worst rollout.
Right. That's right. Yeah.
Okay. And the four arrows that you have drawn, you will perform this kind of all of this patching simultaneously.
I guess the four arrows are a little bit misleading. Basically, what I'm doing is like the first token of the good rollout, I patch to the first token, the worst rollout.
Okay.
The second, and I token vary like which tokens, which positions, depending on which setup I have.
So each tokens get patched to their corresponding tokens.
Exactly. One at a time.
One at a time.
Yeah.
Okay. But the issue here is that.
Oops, sorry.
No. You can only do that when the information in both of these rollouts are kind of sort of like templatic. So you have an idea that you are only changing one thing, or this token here, it has a corresponding token here, which kind of is similar type, but they're only their information is different. Here you don't have control over that.
Yeah, so I agree that's a problem in the good rollout to worst rollout setting, at least the way I have it set up right now. I don't think that's a problem in the bad rollout to bad rollout setting.
Yes, because everything is literally the same.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
But couldn't you draw the same conclusion by just patching at the last token?
Patching at the last token.
Because you force all the way until answer
Yeah.
or something, or boxed, right? And then if you were able to patch something here, some positional pointer.
Yeah. I think that's right.
then you would draw the similar conclusion, right?
Yeah, and I do some of that. The advantage of the setup is you can do that, but you can also account for cases where, like, one thing you might imagine is, like, during the bad rollout, you're keeping track of, like,
whether this is correct.
Well, not so much whether it's correct, because then you would just patch that correctness, better. But whether it's better. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so if you don't know where that information is stored.
Yeah. Wouldn't it be nice if R1 could annotate its own thoughts?
Yeah, that'd be really nice. I would cite that, yeah.
So I have one feedback. Why don't you just remove the bad rollout from the equation? Just change the order. Bad rollout, worst result, and bad rollout, good result. You don't have to do batching over the bad rollout, and let me double check.
I'm not sure I understand. So what would I change?
You just swap the order of good rollout and bad rollout, and swap the order of worst rollout and bad rollout.
So I'd be patching from good plus bad to bad plus worse.
Yeah.
I guess the thing that I was worried about there is that you would be patching both the good question.
What was the recommended setup? Good, bad, and then what's the bottom?
I was saying that just for the first row, swap bad rollout and good rollout.
So bad, good.
And for the second row, swap bad and worse.
So bad, worse.
So now if you look at column-wise, the first column and the second column is literally the same.
Mm-hmm.
It's an autoregressive setup. Patching does not change anything.
Mm-hmm.
You just change good rollout and worse rollout.
Oh, so you just have less to patch because you have this tautology where there's nothing.
Yeah. And now and then you just, but eventually I guess you also want to understand this setup as well. But as a first experiment, that makes things a little bit easier, maybe.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's fewer dependencies.
Yeah.
I think. That's interesting. So I'm gonna have to talk with you about that. Because I have a memory of drawing out all the possible patch combinations.
Okay.
I decided against that, but I can't remember why. So maybe I was wrong.
Okay.
So what happens when you actually do this patching? The main thing that happens is you get something that's impossible to visualize in a small screen. And so I guess I've extracted kind of maybe interesting parts of this. So what I do is I have the tokens going vertically, and on the left column, so if we're just looking at the left plot here, the left column is the good rollout, the right column is the worst rollout, and so I'm patching from good to worse. And then the colors tell you what the change is in the likelihood of the worst token. So, you know, this is very red. And basically what that means is like your this zero token, which is supposed to be the answer for worse, you're clobbering it with the six, which is the answer for bad. So it's like it's never gonna output zero. And then the x-axis is the number of layers. So that's why it's very dark here, and then it gets lighter as you go to the right. And then on the right here, I have just kind of further down. And so as you descend, as you know, as you go through the rollouts and the number of tokens, you mostly see nothing. And then eventually you see this little patch of blue. And then at the end, predictably, you see this red. So, you know, when you patch in basically whatever was going to be output by the good worst rollout, you're patching in the good answer, and so the worst token gets much less likely.
So the answers actually appear at the same token position?
Yeah. So the answers appear at the same because the good and the worst have the same number of tokens. So
do we need to somehow make sure that happens?
Yeah, enforce that they have the same number of tokens.
Okay.
So I do a ton of sampling basically to get these.
And what about the suggestion that Chris mentioned, patching at the last token?
Yeah, so I think my takeaway from at least this single example is you don't really get what you want from patching at the last token.
No, I mean, this is the last of the, I mean, last token of your good and worse.
Last token of your good and worse. Yeah.
This right. is that?
Yeah, so on the right here, this is the last token of the good plus worse, and I'm patching into the last token of the bad, or the, sorry. Yeah, of the worst plus bad. Sorry, okay. This, on the left here is the bad, is the good plus bad, and then on the right is the worst plus bad.
Hopeless bad and worst plus bad. Yeah, my question is that token block token? If you go to your previous slide,
yeah,
is it that backslash blocked token, or is it the last token in your worst rollout?
It's the boxed. Yeah.
Yeah. No. Yeah. So I'm asking
the last
about...
token in the worst rollout is right around here.
That would be bad, right?
That's in bad. Yeah.
Yeah. Worst one.
This
would be bad rollout.
So yes, these are both the bad rollouts. Yes.
Worse and the good. Last token of good and worse.
Oh yeah, where's that?
So the last token of good and worse is
probably here. Doesn't have anything.
So it's
New line.
Okay.
No, not much. Okay.
Was really confusing me.
Yeah.
That you are patching from good to worse, right? But you are tracking the probability of worse result going up and down.
Mm-hmm.
That does not make sense to me. If you're patching from good to worse, you should track the probability of good results going up or down. At least that is how I understand.
But he only wants the pointer.
But he's looking for a pointer.
Yeah. He's looking for a pointer.
The correct answer there is bad without any intervention. Yeah, you just want to flip to the other one. Don't want to make the answer the good one. It's similar to what we
had. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. yeah. So I guess what I take from this is mostly that you cannot make worse more likely. So like, you know, this is maybe a little bit promising, but you know, you get to maybe a 5% difference. Actually. Less than that, maybe
it's like 2%. A lot, right?
Sorry,
5%. You may say it's a lot because the rollouts are long, you're only patching a single token, right?
Maybe. I mean, I guess what it communicates is like if there is a signal, it's probably distributed, like,
yeah,
not a single place,
yeah, might be.
Wait, 1 second before you go further. I think I have been in a similar situation. What I would recommend to do is, so if you patch in all the tokens of your good to worse,
mm-hmm.
it is bound to change at zeroth layer.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's your starting point. Do that. Or
okay.
Start with the zeroth layer, it's going to work. But let's say all the tokens. Just check till which layer it is working. That's going to give you some intuition. And then start to filter out the tokens. I mean, or... The very first thing you could try is patching in only the last token of your worst and good does not work. So patch the last two or last three or last four.
Oh, all at once.
Yeah, all at once. I would assume the information of the sentence may not just be in the last token. It might be a little bit distributed across the last-ish tokens.
Yeah.
That might work.
Okay. Cool. Oh, that's a whole thing. I guess, let me just, yeah, I want to have time for a full thing. So let me just speed through this. The other thing I did is I took kind of like each of every possible head, what their patching score was. If you just patched that head, sorted them by defect, and then kind of, you know, added the first patch the first 20 together, patch the first 40 together. And here again, I'm plotting the change in the worse output. And yeah, you really, you don't get to much.
But these are all the heads in the model.
So these are, all the heads of the model are candidates for this, yeah. At all token positions. And you kind of start leveling off after you get there. I also tried doing evolutionary strategies for all the combination of heads. Like maybe there's something nonlinear going on.
Cool.
You get this Pareto frontier, which is get to about 11% is the best you can do. And that's with 32 patch components. So I think that's somewhere around here. And the best result that you get with that is this guy right here, where you know, zero is the MLP. So the MLP turns out not to be important when I do that. And then, you know, maybe some indication layer 22, 23, 24 are important, but not sure what to make of that. And yeah, so then this is kind of like averaged over the data set. You know, you get similar kind of like nothing particularly dramatic to the effects. So I think that's all kind of the empirical results I had. So Nikhil suggested starting with the first token or the first layer and going from there. Do people have other suggestions?
I actually have another one.
Yeah.
Your setup actually reminded me of when I was looking into the MCQ setup.
Okay.
It was like one, like option, and then finally answer, which is kind of similar to the little bit like you have two options and you need to choose one of them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we may, if you want, we can discuss it later. But yeah, that setup and this setup seemed similar. So you may, that might give you some good intuitions to start with for looking for the underlying mechanism.
Okay, yeah.
I have another suggestion. I think patching across tokens only makes sense if these tokens are of same type and you assume them to have similar types of information. Otherwise, patching across tokens, to me, it does not make sense.
My next steps were, I was going to change the difference between the good and the worst rollout to have that same property, but be just fully aligned and just have different digits.
Yeah.
Would that satisfy
you? Yeah, I think so. And also, like, you can probably have similar templates. Like, this, does this rollout has to be something like that is model generated? You can generate them yourself.
Yeah, I can. Have
flexibility to add templates.
It's harder to build a data set, and I'm also just a little weirded out by, I feel like there might be interesting things going on with like steganography or the model like choosing particular tokens,
or maybe you don't even need templates. You need, let's say you decide on six lines, first line says something like that, second line says something like that, by the final line you actually have the answer, and then you will patch across lines. All the tokens in a line, this type of thing.
That's interesting. Yeah.
I wanted to actually, before seeing your head patching experiments, I wanted to suggest like to do something like patching a single principal component at the last token only,
mm-hmm.
right? To simplify all of this token position mess. But I think it's not going to be more expressive than what you did with the heads. I think what you did with the heads is pretty nice.
Yeah. I think so. Actually, so I think this is, so I did the evolutionary strategies both at the last position and over the full model.
Yeah.
They end up quite similar, which implies that the last token is kind of where it's happening.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I guess that was my conclusion as well.
Yeah, so you can still try it. I mean, people are also trained now SAEs, right, on R1.
Yeah.
And then there's like this recent ICLR workshop papers by Josh, one by Josh and one by Ben Wu, where they look at SAE features that are just always on or more than 10% of
yeah.
the. And there they find a lot of those are actually these positional, like these pointers.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Among other things.
Yeah.
But yeah,
I started doing the SAEs, but I haven't done any analyses. I trained a tuned lens setup for this, but I also have not started to use it. So I think really my next steps are, you know, I feel a little bit limited in kind of coming up with theories for what underlying algorithm is being chosen here. And so, yeah, I'm going to start with these like unsupervised methods first and then have that inform the patching.
David, what's the algorithm you're trying to analyze here? Again,
sorry?
What's the main question?
So you can do that like, I guess, different levels of abstraction. Here, the main question is like, is there some elegant mechanism by which it chooses between two different answers? Can you manipulate that? How does that change if you get to four or five different answers?
I see. Does it naturally happen in these rollouts that it comes up with two different answers?
So if it kind of like gives an answer and then says, wait, let me check. Sometimes the answer will be the same, but a lot of times the answer will be different. And so, you know, after the end of think tag, it kind of has to choose.
Right, but usually aren't those like self-correcting? Like I made a mistake here, so maybe I should correct myself.
Yeah, right. So, so I guess you're saying like, maybe it just always chooses the last answer. Yeah, I don't think that's the case. Maybe that is the case, and maybe that is kind of the mechanism.
Right, because right now it looks like
it's
starting the rollout from scratch again.
Yeah.
And it's like, yeah.
I guess like one indication is, yeah, so if you do this, you know, if you have the good and the bad and you do the standard rollout, it doesn't always choose just the second answer.
Right.
So there's some like discernment going on.
And when you have the deliberation, it is very clean, right? It doesn't always choose the last.
Right. Right.
So like if I replace that with, oh wait, now I have the answer, then would it be always the right last answer?
I haven't tried that. That's,
like usually that's how
the
rollout finishes, right?
Yeah.
It's like now I'm satisfied. And then it's like,
yeah. I don't know. My guess is like you could that would be some signal that you could like put truly terrible rollouts in there and it would self-correct.
Right. So then like pointer should be somewhere here in this I have the answer or like let me choose the right answer.
Okay.
Oh, you think the pointer is actually in here?
Somewhere in here. Maybe like if you change it and it changes to always the last answer. Right. Isn't that like
don't you guys think it's surprising that David hasn't found a pointer at the last token? You know, at the boxed token. The right before the answer is copied there. Wouldn't you expect?
I mean, maybe there's just no pointer.
Find something at the last token.
Yeah.
Right?
I don't think so.
What did you find at the last token position?
What do you think?
Did you bring up the heat map or
the previous slide?
This one.
No, the one before. The one before.
Right here.
You do see something at the last position.
Yeah, but all you're doing is you're eliminating the probability of choosing the worst answer because you're increasing the probability of choosing the good answer. So that's not really what I want. Yeah. So
you expected a blue spike here.
I was hoping for say like obviously there's going to be a red spike at the end.
Yes.
But yeah. I was hoping for something like a blue spike. You know, maybe at the middle layers or like, or, you know, at earlier tokens or something like that.
What do you get for like the token? Like, do you, like, what results did you get for that? Like, if you go back to the template that you have, like at the token for let and I guess the token.
So the token for let is here. So, yeah. Mm-hmm. Not much. And then is here also not that much.
But just to confirm, so the
sorry.
Yeah, so just to confirm, red here is the logit of the good answer. Blue here is the logit of worse answer.
They're both, they're kind of the change in the logit. They're the change in the probability of the worst answer.
Change in the probability of worst answer.
Yeah, so red is the worst answer is less likely. Blue is the worst answer is more likely.
More likely.
It might be interesting to just look at that last token and then plot the three, you know, all three probabilities of the good, bad, and worse.
Yeah.
Another thing that this is probability, right?
Yep.
You probably should wanna look at logits as well because probability, because small changes in logits will not get reflected here.
Small changes in logits will not get reflected here.
Yeah, because probability will just.
Yourself,
yeah. Watch.
Yeah.
It's an exponential scale.
That seems desired by me, right? Because ultimately, what I care about is probability.
But if there is some small changes in logic, something is systematically getting promoted in the logic space, you will not capture it here.
Yeah. I mean, I guess like.
Yeah.
You'll get stuff like with this. There's some small change in probability, so you're saying like. I'll pick up on more logits. I guess the question is like, do I want to pick up on that in this setting?
Yeah, like, yeah, for now. Because right now you're like, I don't see anything. And they're like, well, maybe if you take off your sunglasses, you can see something.
Yeah. Okay.
But yeah, how useful that will be, I have no idea.
Yeah, I can try.
I would be very open-minded to other solutions, right?
Other solutions that the model is implementing?
Yeah.
Like what?
I don't know.
I thought you were open-minded.
I can imagine that, like, you know, the model in the default processing, it just keeps spamming these answers, right?
Uh-huh.
Like a lot.
Yeah.
More than two.
Yeah, lots.
And they repeat.
Sure.
So I could imagine that, like, while doing that, it just maintains some belief about what is the best answer, or like how the answers relate to each other. Like, if I generated five times, the answer is three, and with five different algorithms, which is not the case. Like, often it does, like, oh, let me use a calculator, or let me use the whiteboard. Right, but at least in the chain of thought, you have like five times the answer three occurring. I think that should do something with regards to whether three is a good answer or not. Right. Along the way.
But in this setting where you've got just two, which happens sometimes.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, maybe there. Is a confidence associated with each algorithm, right? The first answer I derived by, I don't know, applying an induction proof, and second answer I did proof by contradiction, but I know I am worse at that, so maybe I trust the first answer more because it's
okay. But still,
yeah.
So even though there's some logic there, if you say I'm going to trust the first answer more. Then at the very end, it's got to copy the answer from the first answer, right? Like, which is
well, you could just move it along all the time,
right? So there's two pipe. I guess it's like I can only think of two ways that information goes. It's either by reference, and it's going to dereference this pointer at the very end, mm-hmm. or it's by value, and it's literally copying the number zero along, you know, so that by the time it gets to the end, it like has the number zero here, or it has the number 66 or whatever, right? And so like I was really surprised, not like it seemed weird and implausible for it to be bringing the number 66 along for it to be by value because of all of Nikhil's stuff that like everything is relentlessly by pointer.
But did Nikhil do Quinn?
No.
Didn't look at Quinn. Maybe Quinn is by value.
So like these are really small models.
Yes.
The small models have this.
How big is it?
1.5 billion.
Only 1.5.
Sure. Oh yeah, and then there is the other thing, right? I mean, it's just a GSM-8K example, so the model might just look at its MLP. It's like, oh, I know, it's like this GSM-8K example, right? It's 66. I just memorized this.
Yeah.
I guess intuitively, like, and then there is no pointer, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
I have one alternate hypothesis which might explain why we are not getting W1. So maybe the correct answer for the good one, the correct answer, like the number token in the good one and the worst one, have different pointers. So I think here right now we are thinking pointer from like a first and second option, first option or the second option. But maybe the numbers have their own pointers. And the answer of in your good rollout, the answer token, let's say, is the fifth number, and the like in your worst rollout, the answer token is, let's say, the seventh rollout.
Seventh token.
Yeah. And hence, when you're patching it at the last token, the model might just be looking at the fifth or the fifth token of the worst rollout, and hence not getting the correct token, which is the seventh one. This is just alternate hypothesis.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. I think the fully templatic good
might resolve some of these.
Yeah.
We'll okay. So that.
Theory, right? Like.
Yeah. So is it like fully templated right now, or are you planning to do it?
No. So right now, the good and the bad are standard rollouts, or just length matched, but not aligned. Whereas if they only differ by the like concrete tokens.
Yeah.
But like, okay. So if the pointer is pointing at the wrong spot, you would you expect to boost like just a random logit corresponding to that spot?
Yeah.
And we are not measuring this right now because we look only at the two candidates.
Yeah,
maybe starting with the counterfactual where your good and the worst just differ by one token, one number, and then checking out if you see a blue one there or not at the last token. I think that might give us a subsequent.
Oh, God.
Cool. How would you force your think tokens to be templated? Wouldn't that be unnatural?
Force my think
token. That's his concern, yeah. It might be a little unnatural.
But because R1 cannot do that.
Right.
I mean, I think the natural, what I was going to do is just because the tokenization is per digit, which is nice, you can just change 2 to 7 here or 2 to 9. And then,
Oh, sorry. I meant like template in terms of like Arnav, what Arnav was saying. They all need to differ in like just one.
Oh.
Well, like Nikhil has a nice template.
That is what I suggested.
Well, you can take like a natural.
I mean, probably you can start with that first and see how it goes, and then you can make it more natural. I mean, as natural as possible.
Exactly.
That's good advice. Start easy.
The problem then it's harder to. Yeah, I can try it. You might not get the scenario that I want where you have order invariance.
Actually, probably that's not what you want. You want template but line wise template, not like token wise or word wise template. Then you will have information which line is communicating this pointer information.
Yeah.
And then once you understand that line, then you can, I don't know, try to impose some template on that specific line, which seems much easier. And I hope that it will be at the answer line. And then it will do exactly what you just suggested.
Yeah, you could do that. So how would you feel about Tal's automatic span labeling solution?
Oh man.
So I like the advice that you're generally getting from the group, which is instead of making it harder, make it easier.
Yeah.
Right, and you, I feel like you're sort of like. Oh, but it makes it less realistic. And then they're sort of saying, well, you can make it more realistic later. right? You like if you don't have signs of life, make it super easy until you see signs of life. Or maybe you still don't see signs of life, even if you make it super easy. And the mystery deepens and you can make it easier and easier.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
I think in speaking of like different ideas, I suppose if we were to think about how, like if your correct answer is 60 and your incorrect answer is 33 or whatever, it's outputting either 60 or 33. Like I would imagine it's one of these attention heads that are promoting either one of these.
Yeah.
And so I think I would focus there and look for specific heads that are, like I suspect you'll find an attention head that not only attends heavily to 66, the correct answer, or 60, mm-hmm. whatever number, like 66, it would not only attend heavily to 66, but by doing so, it also promotes the likelihood of 66. So I would, like if you, instead of like trying to localize by activations, maybe you can try to localize by attention heads.
Now you have some attention head analysis that you did. Does any of it come down to that?
Let me think. So,
like on the next slide.
I mean, here.
Yeah, these kind of things. Did any of that come down to that, or is that?
It didn't seem like there was a single attention head, which was
right. But I imagine if you look at some of these that you highlighted. I would imagine if you look at their attention patterns, you'll see them focusing on, say, 66.
Yeah.
And I imagine, I suppose there are either maybe two scenarios. One is like, I don't think this is likely, but you have one attention head that attends at 66 as well as 30, the incorrect case. And like that attention head is like solely choosing which one to output. I don't think that's likely. I think what instead you'll find is some heads attending to 60, some heads attending to 30. And then it's kind of this competition of like which one wins out. And you, so
do you think this is like kind of just additive process of each attention head?
I think so. Okay. And if that's the case, you could try hacking these heads to see if you can switch, like reliably make it output 60 or 33 and so on.
Yeah. And how would you intervene on those heads?
Intervene on?
How would you intervene on the head to make it output 66?
So either like you can, if you see attention heads heavily attending to 66, you can like dampen those attention patterns maybe, or other way around for the ones attending to 30, you can heighten their attention patterns, or vice versa. You have like their W out vectors, or something. Maybe you scale those larger.
Yeah.
I think there are probably different ways to go about it, but. Like instead of trying to localize with activations, if we think attentions are what's outputting these tokens, I think I would try to localize the attention heads first.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I can. I might talk more.
Yes.
I think that's great. Thanks.
Cool.
Thanks, you guys.
Thanks, everyone.
Yeah.
Part one. I guess how much time should I allot for this?
Oh, I'm not sure. So you can maybe half an hour or something like that.
Okay. All right. Yeah. I will do my best. Okay. So let's see. All right. So here's this like obligatory slide that I have here. And you know the alternative opening picture I was going to use is this tweet I saw by a PhD student, and the tweet was essentially PhD students on the West Coast are very different from PhD students on the East Coast, and my hope is to try and give some like quantitative explanation of what the worldview is here and maybe like how much support there is for it. And so
West Coast PhD students are different from East Coast PhD students?
That's the take, yeah.
So when like Stanford steals, you know, Jude Ng from us,
yeah,
then he transforms as he crosses the Mississippi.
Yeah, that's the theory.
Is that right?
Yeah, yeah. We can ask him.
Yeah.
So I guess just, you know, here is this kind of like attempted history of the past 3 years. And so, you know, he's talking about the hype over language models in 2023. You know, are they actually thinking? Are they not? All this VC money. 2024, you know, the apps aren't really working, but, you know, the chatbots seem to work great. 2025, you know, we get to this like chain of thought process. We get R1, we get rollouts. And, you know, the punchline is that this was written in August 2021. And this was, you know, this is roughly when the stochastic parrots paper came out. Yeah, it's a little bit cherry picked, but I think the kind of like overall picture is quite good. And I think this picture is like impressive evidence of being able to say something useful about AI over the next, you know, 6 years. And so the guy who did this recently released this new...
what's the name of this guy?
This is Daniel Kokotajo. So he used to work at OpenAI, and he left as a whistleblower. And so he has this forecast of, you know, March 2027, AI can do the job of best human coder on tasks involved in AI research. You know, in 8 short months, we get to a super intelligent AI researcher. And then, you know, less than a year later, we get this artificial super intelligence, so better than the best human at every cognitive task. And like, you know, it's very, very scientific, as log normal distributions, confidence intervals. And so, you know, what do people think of this? Some people hate this. I assume this is what most of you are thinking. I'm very sympathetic to this response. But I'm hoping for this presentation to be kind of an intro to what the scientific evidence is for how things are evolving in AI. Okay, and maybe the last thing before we get into it, why should you actually care about this? You know, I think it's like intrinsically interesting. It's I think the heuristic of like know what's happening in your field tends to perform pretty well over time. In particular, I think it's hard to understand how like a lot of the field is approaching things if you don't have a model of what they care about and why. So like, you know, why is Anthropic pushing so hard on SAEs? You know, some of that comes down to timelines that they have. This, you know, maybe fanciful take. This guy is a PhD student at ETH. You know, he's a real dude. This is Daniel Palacka. He was a co-author on the refusals mediated by single direction paper. He co-authored a lot with Nicholas Carlini. But like the actual answer to why you should care is because if you disagree with the forecast that I just showed you, you can bet with them and you can get $100 if you're right. And so I encourage you to pay attention. And if you see something that you think means that, you know, like this approach to forecasting is wrong or fundamentally flawed, then you can get $100. Maybe you can give me some of it as a finder's fee. So here's this big picture that I have when I think about, you know, how AI progress proceeds. So, you know, we start with like essentially Moore's law for GPUs. That's compute. We have how much do you spend on GPUs? That's investment. That combines to get to physical compute. When you combine that with, you know, the flops that you're generating, the algorithms that you have determine how effective that can be at transforming flops into loss numbers. Loss numbers go down as you add more data, as you add more effective compute. And then the loss is transformed, I think, relatively predictably into benchmark performance. And then benchmark performance, I think, less predictably transforms into real-world performance. And then we have these two kind of like why do we care about real-world performance? And so I'm going to talk about this less, but, you know, one answer is obviously investment. So, like, as AI gets better, people spend more money, and you have this flywheel. The other, I think, like, fundamental assumption of this worldview is as you get better models, you will get better algorithms. So you will have these AI researchers. And the question is like, as you increase the effectiveness here, how does that actually like feed into this model? As I've set it up, you have a feedback loop. Does this work? Do you have diminishing returns? That's kind of the question. And you know, is pretty broad presentation, but I'm happy to dive into stuff if people have particular interests, and then also like definitely push back on anything you think is incorrect or having a or maybe like fundamentally flawed.
Were you defining self-improvement previous slide? This one, the feedback loop.
Yeah, am I defining it?
Is that what you're saying? Is that?
I think that is what is implied by this diagram. Yeah.
Because of the arrow up.
Yeah. Yep. I mean, also because of the arrow down, right? You know, if you go from.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Got it.
Is it possible that this cycle breaks because we have limited data?
Yes. Yes, and I will talk about that. So there are a bunch of things that it could make this stop. So the first thing is compute. This is just like pretty empirical. You look at GPUs and you look at like how fast their flop per dollar is improving, and you get a slope of about 2.5 years. So here they say it's about 3 years. On the right, they look at updated numbers. It seems to be closer to 2.5. Those are pretty close in log space. For context, GPT-4 costs about $50 million to train. If you in 10 years, just relying on this, nothing else, you could train GPT-4 for about $3 million. So that's kind of like a rough sense of the effect here. And I plotted these numbers here. So like 1.3x every year, that's about a tenth of an order of magnitude. And then that doubles every 2.5 years. So then we have investment. So investment doubles every 9.5 months. We plotted all these numbers here. So one question is like, how do we get these numbers? So sometimes people will just report them publicly. They'll say like, we spent, you know, X number of flops on Llama. Sometimes you can get it privately through the grapevine. Sometimes you can infer it from public statements. So like, I think Mark Zuckerberg said that they train one of the llamas on like X number of GPUs for X amount of time, and you can kind of like infer. And then sometimes you just have to guess based on loss. Like inference about the number of tokens that are used. The other thing, this is a little bit sensitive to amortization choices. So if GPUs are improving really fast, then you use them for less time. And so they're more expensive because you want to replace them quickly. In this case, it's less important because we know exactly how fast stuff is improving. But you know, for forecasts, that's something you want to take into account. And so when you combine investments and compute, you get this combination. So we're at about every year, the amount of like actual flops that we spend on frontier models goes up by about 3 times. So that doubles every 7 months. And so then we have this question of like, that's our calculation. Does this match what we see empirically? It actually undercounts a little bit what we see empirically. So one reason is quantization. Another reason, so you can get kind of like more flops out of the same GPU. Another is just data center efficiency. So in general, like, you know, memory gets better, you move things back and forth. I guess for now I'm going to stick with the slightly lower numbers in the interest of conservatism. So I'm just going to add these together, but these are roughly what you expect to see in real life. So let's take a look at algorithms now. So this is the first one that I was a co-author on. So I'm going to go into a little bit more depth. So, you know, we have this fundamental question, like GPT-4 is a lot better than GPT-2. How much of that is compute, just like raw compute, and how much of that is stuff like, you know, group query attention, glue, RMS norm, you know, whatever fancy algorithms people are using now. The answer seems to be that it's mostly compute. So you can see at the bottom here, we have this is physical compute scaling. And then algorithmic progress in particular, it's the amount of compute needed to reach a fixed level of performance halved every 8 months. And My big takeaway from this paper, honestly, is that the transformer is alone 20% of the algorithmic gains. So it does a really good job of converting flops to loss reductions. But how do we actually know this? So we took all these language models, we evaluated them, or like took their public evaluations on PenTreeBank and Wikitext. And for all of them, we collect parameters, data, and loss. And so we start with this Hoffman scaling law. This is the chinchilla scaling law. And so, you know, what that says is that you start with the irreducible loss. This is roughly the entropy of the data set. Then you have these constants, and then you have these exponents for parameters and data. And so our model assumes that, you know, the kind of like multiplier for parameters and for data grows exponentially over time. And so we have this model, you know, Y0 doesn't really matter, but we chose, I think, 2012 here. And we fit this data. So we have, we're estimating alpha year, alpha parameters, beta data, and beta year. And we have variants of this, but most of them perform roughly the same. And so, you know, that gives us this top level number of algorithmic progress halves every 8 months. We also want to disentangle, like, you know, how much of it is parameter scaling, how much of it is data scaling, how much of it is parameter efficiency, data efficiency. And so what we do there is we use Shapley values. So we have this like nonlinear model. So we can't just take the coefficients of all these things. And we, maybe I won't get into details here, but we basically take the average marginal contribution of every player that we have here over all the combinations that you can imagine. Or, you know, first we would do parameter scaling, then data scaling, or first we would do data scaling and then parameter scaling, et cetera. And so what you see is like it varies pretty widely across models, but generally parameter scaling is more important. Data scaling is, you know, the second most important, and data efficiency. Parameter efficiency does not really matter that much. And, you know, some of this is a little bit confounded because earlier in, you know, the 2015 to say 2022, we were much more doing parameter scaling. Now we're much more doing data scaling after chinchilla. But overall, those are the results that you get.
How do you define efficiency?
So this is kind of the, you know, how you convert data into loss reduction. So if you have higher data efficiency, as you increase data, you get more loss reduction for every doubling of data that you get.
So the two columns on the right are the kinds of things that PhD students might hope to work on. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And, you know, I guess like one takeaway I have from this worldview is mostly you don't want to be working on capabilities because it's pretty boring and pretty predictable. But I think people could disagree with it. I guess the transformer to get that in particular, you know, you can add a indicator variable and refit the model and then look at, you know, if you flip it on, if you flip it off, we get what I said, which is about, you know, seven times less compute to get the loss reduction that you'd want. And then that's 20% of algorithmic progress.
Yeah.
Interestingly, so yeah, so one limitation is we use the chinchilla scaling law. It turns out chinchilla scaling law, which was a correction of the Kaplan scaling law, is a little bit wrong. They didn't let their optimizer run to convergence, apparently. And so it maybe underestimated a little bit the importance of data. And so maybe like you should shade these up a little bit. And then we also, you know, we're just looking at like the number of tokens to loss reduction. And so that doesn't distinguish between data quality and, you know, like an incredible Swigloo innovation. So I guess, you know, I first heard this from Matthew Barnett, who worked at Epoch, and his take was that, you know, in general, you have a lot of these domains where algorithmic progress tends to grow at roughly the same rate as, or, you know, close to the same rate as compute progress. And so, you know, if you look at chess engines, like as you get more compute, you get better algorithms. And, you know, there are a couple of different things you could imagine for that, for like why that is. But, you know, one is just like you have this problem of like you need to experiment. You need to like try lots of algorithms. And for that, you need to compute. And then you have this twin problem of like maybe algorithms only apply at a certain scale. And so they don't become relevant. I think this is particularly important because, you know, if you think AI researchers can be automated, you think this is right, you're going to have to account for this problem where you're capped by experimentation. You're going to need to figure out some way that you can get kind of like better sample efficiency for your AI researchers without just spending physical compute.
This the previous slide,
yeah,
that goes against the bitter truth, right?
This one.
Yeah. If the algorithmic improvements is on par with the compute one, doesn't that go against the bitter truth?
Yeah. I mean, I think it depends on A, what your baseline was for what you think the bitter lesson was telling you.
Okay.
But, you know, I think if you were trying to recover that, you would say something like, you know, all this algorithmic progress, like, it really only works because they're just trying lots of stuff. And there's kind of like, you know, a lot of these experiments are automated. So they're trying like 12 different kinds of squiggly variations. But, you know, certainly like insights are important. Yeah.
One point. I was reading this book, The Human Computation, Human Comparative.
Yeah.
It's too rough.
Yeah.
I think one example that is coming on to my mind from that book is what he says is, I think he was trying to explain how research generally works, that we try out a lot of things in research lab, only one or two things actually get ended up in a real actual product.
Yeah.
And he was actually giving example of a chess engine. I don't know the detail, but I think what he has mentioned there is the actual algorithm was more or less known by the 1960s. And it was only when the compute become more and more accessible, the look ahead algorithm become more and more like actually useful, that it can be on par with the human and then later be able to beat up the human in the chess game.
Yeah.
And that seems to again align with the bitter truth one.
Yeah. So I guess my, you know, I don't remember this Katya Grace paper super well, but my memory of that paper is what she found is that you know, that was the bulk of how you improve chess engines. But like, you know, if you took algorithms from today and applied them 20 years ago, like you would get serious improvements.
Okay.
So, you know, there are like little things you can do on the edges, you know, ways you can be smarter about like which nodes in the MCTS tree you're choosing. Okay, so that's algorithms. When we combine algorithms with physical compute, we get effective compute. And, you know, this is interesting because, you know, for one thing, like SB 1047, if people remember that bill, would peg the trigger at which these models became subject to state scrutiny at, you know, I think it was 10 to the 26 flops. But that was effective compute. That was not physical compute. And so as, you know...
Other way around.
That was...
They regulated physical compute, right?
I think they regulated effective compute.
Oh, really?
Physical compute, yeah. And so... Yeah, you're right. And so, you know, but the implication is like, as time goes on, the amount of compute that you would actually need to reach the same performance would fall by about three times every year. And so you have to like make this choice of like, how do you actually want to, you know, which one of these is relevant, and how fast do you think algorithms are going to improve?
Can you remind or can you explain briefly how to read this?
Yeah.
So now you have like 8.9x, 0.9500ms, and 3.8 months or something.
Yeah.
And what does this mean now?
So, you know, the first line is the multiplier per year. So every year you get 9 times more effective compute. The second one, these are all just different ways of expressing the same number. So, you know, roughly you get 10x per year. Yeah, it's 0.95 orders of magnitude.
Oh,
and,
okay.
And then every 4 months, the amount doubles.
Okay.
So that's very fast. You know, this is like, you have to get like very rapid diminishing returns on loss to keep that up. So I'm not going to spend a ton of time on data, but just, you know, as a takeaway, like people use a lot of it. It's going up exponentially, like all these things. And there's this question of like, are we going to run out? So if you, you know, if you estimate based on the total stock of public data, what you get is about a median date of 2027 when we run out. Some of that depends on, you know, how much you expect models to be overtrained. So this is assuming that they're going to be trained with 5 times more tokens than Chinchilla would tell them to. But, you know, it turns out not to be super sensitive to that number. And yeah, the fundamental dynamic you get is like this thing is going up inexorably, and you're hitting this, like, you know, we are creating more text, but we're not creating it that fast. And so what do you do? So you can undertrain, so you can return to parameter scaling. So you can use the same number of tokens, but just more parameters. You can pay for more data, so like pay scale AI, pay New York Times, all these private data stocks. You can use synthetic data, which is what we're increasingly seeing. And you can train for more epochs. So it seems to be like, I don't know, somewhere between 3 and 12 epochs does not seem to be, you don't seem to hit diminishing returns. And then you can also use other modalities. So there's just a ton of genomics data. There's a ton of like video data out there. And you know, I think unclear how much that'll be useful. But epoch, when you account for all that, you know, this was not something I worked on, but they estimated that you would get, you can scale up to about 2 times 10 to the 30 flop without hitting diminishing returns. And so, you know, that's like maybe, you know, 4 more years of scaling, something like that. So, yeah, we have effective compute going very fast.
How did they estimate diminishing returns? Just because it hits like human generated text? Like the cap of my generated text.
So, like, why you get diminishing returns when you train on multiple epochs or just in general?
I mean, why is human generated public text like the cap? Like, why is there no synthetic ceiling?
Oh, so this. This image right here does not talk about these other things. So this is purely on if you only want to use public text. Yeah, so I won't go into details here, but when you plug these numbers here into the Chinchilla, adjusted Chinchilla scaling laws, what you get is that the reducible loss goes down by about 33% a year. And so, you know, the question is like, is this really something we should care about? Is loss like relevant? In some theoretical sense, yes. So, you know, in principle, like zero loss implies indistinguishability, right? And so if you have a loss, you also have a number which tells you how many tokens it will take to distinguish between these two distributions at a certain level of confidence. And so, you know, what this approach is doing is it's saying like, well, if you assume that, you know, you have some number of tokens that you care about, you know, for example, like if you have the length of an average scientific paper, which is about 5,000 tokens, and you assume that humans are some multiple worse than an optimal predictor at distinguishing between distributions. So like, you know, you get a token, you're like, is that a scientific paper? Is that not? How many tokens will it take for you to get like, you know, 10% confident?
And what this model tells you is like it's pretty uncertain. So a lot of that is, you know, uncertainty. What this model does is it has uncertainty in like all the scaling law parameters, uncertainty in the slowdown parameter, how much worse humans are. And, you know, you'll notice it has like substantial loss on numbers that we've already reached. It also has substantial probability mass on numbers that, you know, we will never reach. They're just like certain physical limits.
So, I'm totally not following what this is about. You talked about how many tokens I need to distinguish a generated paper from a human paper.
Mm-hmm.
And then you switch to this plot on the right side.
Yeah. So this plot on the right is saying if you want, it's trying to quantify given a like non-ideal predictor. So given a predictor that needs, you know, 2 times as many tokens or 10 times as many tokens.
Okay.
To predict, and you use the scaling laws that we have, how many flops will you need to train a model such that it can fool this predictor, basically, over 5,000 tokens?
So, like, your predictor is like you're trying to estimate how many flops would it take to fool a human?
Exactly.
Right. So, yep. So we'll posit that you have a model of a human here.
Yep.
Right. And so you're saying that there's some uncertainty in that, mm-hmm. but here's your bell curve of like, you would need, you know, under some range of assumptions, you would need something like this number of flops to pull a human where the human couldn't tell the difference between a scientific paper made by an AI and a scientific paper.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. A scientific paper.
Now, there's a little bit of a gap here, right? Because we all know that, you know, the point of the review process is not to find scientific papers that are in error, right? The point of the review process is to find scientific papers that are written well and, you know, use the idioms correctly and are self-consistent and, you know, do all this type of stuff. But like the sort of findings of truth, like come outside of reading the papers, they come out of like a much slower process of like reproducing the results and that type of thing. Right. So I'm not sure, like, is getting through like the equivalent of peer review of like making a readable paper really the thing that we care about? Or actually is it like producing true research, which is actually, you know, it's like a harder thing.
So I guess my take is like you should not trust this for a bunch of different reasons. That's one of the reasons I wouldn't trust it, but it's not the highest reason I wouldn't trust it. I think like if you could get, you know, according to, you know, this kind of predictor, a indistinguishable scientific paper, you would see quite a bit of progress. Like that would be significant. You know, you wouldn't necessarily have to like just grab the papers, but it could do a lot in terms of like, you know, writing up results, proposing new results, that kind of thing. I guess, you know, for those reasons and others, like this is more kind of a theoretical argument. In practice, there's this question of like, does loss predict benchmark performance, you know, empirically? And the answer to that is mostly yes. So the right plot here is plotting compression, so bits per character, which they get out of cross entropy loss, and against the average benchmark performance. And so they look at a few different domains, so knowledge and common sense, coding, mathematical reasoning, you know, the correlations are all above 0.9. And then here is a project that David Owen at EPEC did where he was looking at scaling a sigmoid to Big Bench and MMLU. And what he found is that, you know, you have this like reasonably good fit. And then if you predict on held out data, these yellow dots, you also get kind of roughly what you would expect. So, you know, not perfect, but like seems better than a lot of things that we use as proxies. And so, okay, I guess I'm running up on time here, but I will skip through Yeah, so I guess like that's why I have a solid line between loss and benchmark performance. But there are a lot of different things that go into benchmark performance. And so, you know, one thing we've seen with O1 is like how long you run the model. In this project that we did at Epoch, we looked at, you know, in general, how do you trade off between inference and training compute? And so that has, you know, a bunch of implications, which I'll get into in a second. I guess to toot our own horn a little bit, we started this, I think, a few weeks after ChatGPT came out. I think turned out to be relatively prescient in terms of like how, you know, O1 and R1 start operating. So yeah, I'll kind of like skim through these, but with overtraining, you train for longer. And your inference is therefore cheaper at a constant loss rate. So like we started to see with Llama, and now we see this lots of places because you want to deploy lots of places and only train once. The second is MCTS. And so, you know, you can search through the search tree at more nodes, skip pruning, repeated sampling. And so, yeah, we have the summary here of like what we found. In general, it's you know, something like 1 to 2 orders of magnitude before you start leveling off, with the exception being repeated sampling, but for various reasons, I would trust that less. So I guess my speculations as a result of that are like, you know, there are limits to this approach. So we're not going to get O1, super O1 by just like continuing to run it. And you know, you also can't get like a cheap inference frontier level model. Here we have this, like, this seems to be clearly true. Labs are going to keep their best models private. So we're not going to have access to the best models. They're going to run them a few times and then use that model as training data. And then the last thing, which I think is kind of cute, is, you know, in general, the total amount of training on inference and compute, if you assume this substitutability, should be roughly equal for a particular lab. And so, you know, as you get more users, you probably want to like overtrain more and get cheaper inference. And so it's like maybe a little bit of a quality inducer. Okay, so I guess like the top level takeaway here, you know, unclear how we get from benchmarks to real world performance, but I feel like academia kind of has that. Real world performance to algorithmic progress, I think, is like kind of the sexy topic in a certain community right now. And, you know, I don't know if people saw the meter study, which is maybe a little bit less externally valid than people think, but I think still pretty interesting. And then the final thing is this you know, link between real world performance and investment, which I don't have time to get into, but I would encourage people to check out this model that Epoch released called GATE, which kind of supersedes an earlier model I did, which looks at as you get more economically valuable AI, how does that translate into investment and compute and progress? And I think uses pretty respectable kind of economic models that real economists like, some of them at least. And it's fun to play with. It's interaction for them. Yeah, so that's my presentation.
So your conclusion is, so like do you feel like so you started off with the story of the 2027 essay.
Yeah.
So is the author of that essay basing their work on this kind of?
Yeah, so they cite a lot of Epoch work, and it's pretty like consonant with this kind of general approach.
I see.
Yeah. I, you know, to be clear, I don't want to like fully endorse this, but I do think if you're more than 85% confident in either direction, like I would love to argue with you. I think you should be open to many possibilities here.
What's the other direction?
Well, you can either think you're going to get self-improving, recursive superintelligence, or you can think like it's just going to fizzle and we're going to get like basically what we have now, but with like 7,500
models. There can be bet on this.
Yeah, I will send you the link. I can put it in the Discord. Yeah.
They just want to get the money.
They do say you're more likely to bet you if you're prominent. So you might need to get, like, you know, David to launder his.
Oh. So I thought this is like some. There's also this betting market places, right?
Yeah, I don't know if you can do real money. I guess you can do on like Kalshi or. Yeah, but they don't have real money, do they? Yeah. But yeah, you can win lots of fake money.
Nice.
So, wait, did you argue that it cannot self-improve? or it can?
So, yeah, I kind of punched it on that. I think it can. But I think you have to be really careful about accounting for diminishing returns in a lot of different ways. And you have to account for a lot of uncertainty on those. And if you do that rigorously, what you get is just this like incredibly wide distribution of benefits.
I have a quick question.
Yeah.
So, like, given this context, and maybe, you know, AGI doesn't happen the way we're thinking, you know, like 85% likelihood, confidence, whatever, like, who knows what's going on. But if there is a, you know, like a 2 to 4 timeline of AGI, mm-hmm. to the people in this room, what is the point of interpretability? And like in what ways does the research everyone here or the peers at other universities are the research that people are doing now? How does that like directly track to like the impact for like, you know, once we hit AGI, like a safe trajectory?
So, yeah, I don't want to answer for everyone. I guess my answer is like, most people do not buy into that. And I also do not buy into like 2 to 4 year timelines. In general, I think like if you did buy into 2 to 4 year timelines, you could be saying something like you want to do research that will accelerate interpretability for AIs when they're doing.
I also think this argument kind of hinges on the fact that like interpretability is going to be a silver bullet to solving like alignment, but I think interpretability is more useful. Like I think Neil had a really good recent post where it's like interpretability is useful for just like being generally useful for safety techniques and like understanding and debugging weird behaviors. And this is like kind of a wild thing to work on.
I think it's also necessary to get past laws and regulations, right? I mean, you're never going to be allowed to use your model if you don't know what it does in order to predict my credit score, at least in reasonable countries.
I mean, some of the, I think the worldview here is that you only need one country and then that country outcompetes the other countries. But I agree with that.
It's silly.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Yeah, I never know which like side to push here, but I think it's unlikely, but it's possible.
David, what was that capability argument you were talking about? We should not work on capabilities.
Oh, I think if you look at like, you know, this plot of the relative contribution of algorithmic progress to total progress, I think the regularity implies that there's kind of just like that, you know, there are some dynamics that are self-reinforcing and you don't really need to contribute in that way. You should contribute in ways that kind of would not get rewarded and reinforced. It's a little bit of a hot take. Like I think you can have problems with that, but I think it should imply that, like, you know, you have this flywheel going of economic inputs and kind of like experiments are limited by experiments. There are all these ways in which like it's priced in.
You're arguing for the agency, so you sort of thing you're saying that. Well, you don't need to do it because if you didn't do it, somebody else will do it.
Yeah,
it'll just happen.
Yeah.
So there's economic forces,
and then also like if you didn't do it, they'd get like slightly worse at it, but they'd have more compute, and so like it wouldn't go down that much. Like compute is kind of the limiting factor. You know, there are lots of fields where you can have like counterfactual impact that you would not have if you're trying to find a better optimizer.
I see.
Thank you, David.
Yeah, thanks.
And if people want to find me and argue, I'm happy to take either side.
You take whatever the other side is.